And how are you doing? I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector here on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. We're coming to you from our studios here in New York City. You're welcome to join us on the radio at 888-874-4888. That's a free call. Once again, 888-874-4888. We're talking about democratization on this program, but we're talking about it, what's happening in Egypt, which the whole world is watching. A tragic effort by a dictator to hold on to power using violence and force, using thugs and secret policemen to attack protesters, to arrest human rights activists, as well as journalists, and attack journalists, which has been continuing. New York Times headline today, Egypt officials widen crackdown. U.S. in talks for Mubarak to quit. Chaos in the streets. Government offering concessions in a bid to gain support. So the situation in Egypt in some ways is getting better or getting worse. Today, they say this is the Friday of departure. Will Mubarak leave? Will he depart? We'll be discussing this today with Michael Brenner, who is a senior fellow of the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the Johns Hopkins University. He's at the University in Texas, I believe, today in Austin, Texas. And then Carolee Kunz is going to be on. She's a blogger and a writer who's also been writing about Egypt. We may have some other surprises for you. So stay with us here on News Dissector Radio every week at this time on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. We're going to start off the program with a song, an anthem of freedom for the people in the Arab streets, the people who are standing up rather heroically, bravely, and courageously against the power of a repressive regime. We're all watching it. We all know that that regime has been in power for 30 years thanks to the support of the United States military, the support of our own country. So even though they're fighting to free Egypt, they're also, in a way, challenging American foreign policy. And that's an issue we're going to be taking up with Professor Brenner, who has a brilliant take on all of this. So stay with us here, 888-874-4888, News Dissector Radio. Thanks for joining us.
أحب عيشة الحرية أحب عيشة الحرية زي طيور بين الأقصى مدى الحبايب حواليا كل البلاد عندي أوطان مطرح ما يجي بيني النوم أنام وأنا مرتاح.
Well, that's a song by Stefan Saeed, whose father is Iraqi, who lives in America, lives here in New York. Stefan is going to try to get down during this radio show to actually play the song live for us and discuss it, because this is an effort to offer support and solidarity to the people in Egypt who have been battling all week against the Mubarak regime and the people who support it. So hopefully Stefan will be here. But our first guest this morning, Michael Brenner. He's the author of numerous books, over 60 articles and published papers. His recent works on American foreign policy in the Middle East are Fear and Dread in the Middle East and Democracy Promotion and Islam. He's written Nuclear Power and Nonproliferation, The Politics of International Monetary Reform. The man is very, very, very smart, and he's been following these events closely. He's directed funded research projects with colleagues at leading universities and institutes. Michael, thank you so much for joining us this morning. And joining us as well, Sherry Welsh, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you for inviting me.
My pleasure. And just I want to acknowledge Sherry's presence, who actually produces the show. She's coming to us from Atlanta, GA, and she's really helping to invigorate this broadcast, vitalize it, make it relevant. Thank you, Sherry, for coming on. I'm sure. What's the latest in Egypt, Sherry, from what you've been watching?
The government officials have now joined the massive protest. I don't understand why Mubarak just hasn't left.
Well,
but that's something the professor probably has great commentary about.
So your take on where we are right now in Egypt, Michael Brenner?
Well, I mean, at this point, it's difficult to predict exactly what's going to happen. I mean, we know the forces at work, and let's kind of, you know, briefly summarize them. I mean, you have a massive rejection of the Mubarak regime. His level of support in the country, if by all indications, you know, for the last sort of several years has, you know, probably been in the single digits if you were to do an American style sort of, you know, sort of survey. At the same time, I mean, there's sort of formidable forces and interests, who see, you know, whose aim is to preserve, at the very least, the basic structure of the current regime, and, for some, Mubarak as well. You know, who are these forces? In the military. I mean, Egypt has had, for all intents and purposes, a military government, since it's, the military sent, the king packing back in, you know, 60 years ago. The regime works for them and for their interests, and they are just very reluctant to give up power. I think for them, the decision that they're agonizing over now is, do we dump Mr. Mubarak in an effort to preserve the essential sort of structure of the regime, or do we stick with him? I don't think that Mubarak is in a position to give sort of commands that will be automatically observed unless they are agreed to and sort of backed up by his military cohort. And then the other big factor are external parties, which means the United States and the Obama administration. They've equivocated because they've been trying to square the circle. And in fact, reconciling on the one hand, what they see as an American interest in Mubarak as, you know, as emblematic of stability. And they genuinely believe that he contributes to the advancement of American policies on three key fronts. You know, Israel, oil, and terrorism. I think those are all very dubious judgments, but as long as they believe that, they are just going to continue this balancing act of attempting, in effect, to maintain an Egypt who conforms to American foreign policy specifications, without at the same time, on the other hand, I mean, abandoning what is a mass democratic movement.
You know, the last night, I don't know if you saw this or not, but the Daily Show, Jon Stewart had Mike Mullen on, the admiral who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He showed up in his uniform. The program started with Justin Bieber, ended with Mike Mullen. And Mullen just started talking about, you know, how he's been on the phone constantly with his, quote, counterparts in Egypt, that the United States trained probably tens of thousands of military officers there, that they're, you know, hoping for a resolution, that the Egyptian military and the Pentagon are very close friends, and that they're, I mean, it was very revealing in a way. I don't think he meant it to be revealing, but, you know, it's sort of the dictates of empire, you know.
Yes,
these are our guys, and we're, you know, we're trying to convince them it's going to take a little time, etc. and so forth. At the same time, the situation seems to be out of his control, maybe even out of Mubarak's control. I mean, we've heard reference now to the idea that we heard years ago in South Africa of a third force, of a basically autonomous kind of repressive army that's doing its thing, nominally under the control of the government, but, you know, doing it their own way, and maybe Suleiman is directing it. Who knows?
Right. Well, I think the three fallacious ideas circulating in Washington and being propagated, you know, by the administration are to a large extent accepted. One is the notion that this regime and Mubarak in power sort of serves American interests, those three key interests I mentioned. At this point, I think any sort of logical assessment of the situation would point in the opposite, direction. This is a godsend to any of those elements, who might even be considering violent terrorist acts against the United States. Avoiding them is supposed to be our number one priority. But when you foster hatred of the United States to the extent in which American sort of equivocation, non-action, previous support for Mubarak and other dictators, does, you in effect, pursuing policies that are counterproductive. But the fallacious idea, one of them, Mullen, represents sort of two notions that are highly, dubious. One is that when we enter into these military-to-military, multidimensional links with people like the Egyptian military, and the same is true in Iraq, Afghanistan, or wherever, that we instill in them the democratic ethos of the military being subordinate to civilian authority, et cetera, et cetera. It simply doesn't work that way. It's not that simple. Anyway, these people are ruthless. They have their own interests. They have their own way of looking at the world, and that's going to be the basis for their action, not sweet words coming from the guys in Washington with whom they occasionally would share dinners, drinks, or were together at Fort Leavenworth.
Yeah, also, don't you have to know something about what they've actually done over the last 30 years? The torture that they've committed, the ruthless way they've obstructed democratic elections, the oppressive environment, the economic disaster in Egypt, all of these things seem to be, the administration seems to be oblivious to. I don't get it.
Well, there's a lot of self-delusion in Washington, and it's been particularly pronounced during what I call the 9/11, decade. Let me know just a couple of things. First, Americans generally believe that we were born in a condition of original virtue. And everything we do is not only virtuous, but anyone who comes in contact with us kind of absorbs and assimilates some of this American virtue, if you like. It's a conceit. It's not, you cannot substantiate it, sort of obviously, but it does distort vision.
We're number one.
We're the best, not just number one, but by all counts we're number two. This also is one contributing factor to another conceit, and that's our ability to shape the political life and the affairs of people who we don't really understand in depth and who are alien to us to a large extent in terms of culture, civilization, history, or whatever. We've run into that in Iraq, we've run into it in Afghanistan, and now when this sort of, jerry-built regime in Egypt that we've been bolstering and leaning on both for so long is on the point of collapsing, we just sort of refuse to recognize it because it becomes sort of inconvenient to have to face up to the truth that this is a place we thought we knew, we thought we can count on, where we did not predict instability at the seams.
Brian Williams was on NBC late the other night, and he was asked to sum up the situation, what he was watching. He was on a balcony overlooking, a lot of gunfire going on over a bridge near the Egyptian Museum. And,
right.
he was asked, how would you sum this up? And he used two words, Mad Max. I mean, in other words, he reached into American popular culture, and, that sort of summed it up for him. And that was kind of bizarre to me.
It is bizarre because, we send over those anchors who don't have a clue about Egypt or anything else. They're there just to juice up ratings. Most of American journalists who even station in these countries don't know the language. Just think back on the extraordinarily sort of dense, superficial reporting which came out of Iraq from American journalists holed up in the Green Zone, none of whom knew any Arabic. We would say
to translate that into a New Yorkese, they didn't know bupkis. Okay.
That's absolutely true, and it came across in the reporting, just stitching together, in effect, communiques from American, central command. Look, they didn't, well, I'll come right back to Egypt in a moment. Look, these people were in the green zone. The Iraqi politicos and government was the other end of the green zone. It would have been completely safe to get on your skateboard or tricycle, go down there, get to know some of these guys, and develop some insight into Iraqi politics.
That would be the easy thing to do.
without putting yourself in danger. And they never did that, which is why they missed every major political development in Iraq, at the Baghdad end, leaving aside the Washington end.
Well, let's talk about this Washington end for a moment, because you've written recently about the Obama administration.
Yeah.
You were sort of sympathetic to it at one point. It seems like, their kind of ossified worldview or whatever it is just incapable of dealing with this. I mean, the contradictions there are Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, the rhetoric on the one hand and the reality on the other.
Let's say, first of all, there's an intrinsic difficulty, if not impossible, challenge in trying to reconcile our supposed dedication to fostering and promoting democracy and at the same time relying on hard men and hard policies to protect what we see as American interests in the region. And when push comes to shove, you simply cannot reconcile those things. What they're hoping to do is to reconcile them to use another metaphor, to pull to an inside straight. It's not going to work. What I suspect happened is that when the Obama made his call to Mubarak, he was simply not very forceful. And there's this, typical vintage Obama. You fudge, you qualify, you hesitate. Of course, unless you're condemning progressives when the man's real convictions and passions come out. And I don't think you budge someone like Mubarak with that tone. And I'm almost certain that was the tone.
On the other hand, that when this guy Frank Wisner Jr., son of a longtime CIA spook and coup maker, was dispatched there and met with Mubarak. The New York Times reported, there was this one phrase that just got my attention. He was told. In other words, this idea that we are going to tell these people what to do and they have no interests and no worldview outside of what we tell them, I think is asking for a complete disaster.
It's naive. And if you know who Mubarak is, right? And let's face it, we've been made fools over the last few years by other tough men with other motivations in other places. Even Maliki in Iraq turned the tables on us when we tried to get him to sign on to a long-term American presence in Iraq. Karzai plays us for fools. Kayani in Pakistan plays us for a fool. Musharraf played Bush as the foil for a fool. Yet we don't learn anything from that. And if you're going to deal with a guy like Mubarak, and if you genuinely want to force him out, and I think the administration has equivocated and still equivocates, although probably at this point they would much prefer to have kind of a custodial military government with Mubarak gone. But if you equivocate, you're not going to get where supposedly you want to go. If you wanted to get rid of Mubarak, you get on the phone and you lay down, look, if you do not, here's what's going to happen. Cut off military assistance, cut off economic assistance, denounce you in public, bring them out of the UN Security Council. I'm not sure it would work. But that's the way you got to play the game with those kind of people at that level if you want to achieve what supposedly you want to achieve.
And supposedly,
Obama talking to you know, talking to, sorry, Obama talking to Mubarak the way he talks to the Republicans in Congress. I mean,
we want a bipartisan solution, right? I mean, in a sense, this is a international reflection of that, Sherry. You know, let's all get along with each other. Let's not stand up against them. Let's try to work this out. We'll give you a little, you'll take a little. You know, it's like this sort of compromise approach to everything, and nobody ends up getting what they want anyway in a situation like that.
Well, some people get what they want. I mean, the Republicans got what they wanted out of Obama. The health industry in Wall Street got exactly what they wanted out of Obama.
Point taken.
It's he, or not he, in his own person, in terms of his own personal and political ambitions. It's his supposed supporters who get nothing. But that's my very jaundiced take on Mr. Obama.
Yes,
but,
message in all caps.
Yeah?
I have a question for you. You wrote a piece about escaping Aladdin's cave.
Yeah.
And you talked about the existing premises as to our interests
in
the greater Middle East, and that there were five core premises. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, I don't know if we have time to kind of run them down sort of systematically, but, I mean, the first is this idea that you can contain the threat of terrorism, which is very loosely and broadly defined, right? By backing any potentate, any despot who claims that he too is an enemy of terrorism. Second proposition is that any Islamist-tinged political force constitutes a potential terrorist threat, either because they themselves can morph into a kind of Iranian-like theocracy, or because they will express sort of sympathy to people who, you know, Al-Qaeda in its various versions. And that's the way we characterize the Muslim Brotherhood, Hamas, Hezbollah, etc. And as a result, you get yourself into a political straitjacket. These are not terrorist organizations. They don't aim at the United States. Their political agenda is local. And indeed, as I said, you know, a few moments ago, it's counterproductive because you're creating more people, with passions about the United States who could do something. The Muslim Brotherhood connection to present or future to terrorist acts against the United States is zero. And yet, in every news story you see, there are these expressions of dread that maybe the Muslim Brotherhood, by the way, whose popularity in Egypt is greatly exaggerated, are going to turn Egypt into an anti-American state.
Well, this is the Fox News worldview. You know, there has to be an enemy.
I mean, there's not a story in the New York Times that doesn't talk about the administration's anxieties and fears about the Muslim Brotherhood acquiring influence in Egypt.
To what degree do you think?
Everything.
To what degree do you think Israel has contributed to this? I mean, I'm sure Israel, Netanyahu, the Mossad have some sort of channel in here, are talking to Mubarak too.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Israelis admit that they've been talking to Mubarak. They reached that agreement to send Egyptian military forces into Sinai, which the old, you know, Sadat-era accords preclude, so that they can make sure that the Gazans don't take advantage of the disorder to break out of their cage on the Egyptian side. I don't think the Israelis, or I don't think the Egyptians need Israeli help in terms of suppressing the opposition in Egypt itself, but I think where it came into play was you had very strong views expressed by Netanyahu directly to Obama, and you had pressures in Washington from, you know, Israeli backers, you know, making the simplistic point that Mubarak is a cornerstone of peace in the Middle East, and all kinds of terrible things can happen if he goes, so don't do anything that would result in a general breakdown of political order in Egypt.
And we saw how the Obama administration stood firm on its policy against settlements in the Palestinian territory.
Well, so, I mean, talking about strong-willed people who have played Obama for the fool, you know, I mentioned Kayani and Maliki, et cetera, and Musharraf, you have to add Netanyahu, who humiliated Obama, humiliated him on repeated occasions. And Obama, you know, just kind of wipes his face and goes on making believe it hadn't happened. And You know, I've made these sort of rough parallels between Obama's behavior on other issues and some domestic, and his attitudes and behavior in regards to Mubarak in Egypt. The point is, we somehow assume that what we do and don't do and things we say in public are not followed, picked up, interpreted, and understood by other peoples because they're either too dense or stupid to do so. You know, someone like Mubarak has survived this far because he reads people and attitudes. And he knew who he was dealing with. And when Obama got on that phone, you know, Mubarak knew that he was a man who could be played with. And I'm sure that the whole tone, as we said a moment ago, of Obama sort of confirmed that.
Now, just one point here about the media coverage. The media has been attacked of late by some of these Islamic thugs, rather, Egyptian thugs, government thugs and the like. But, you know, there's been some articles in the press, you know, how Al Jazeera has provided the best coverage, yet it's been, you know, basically shut down in Egypt. With no reference.
Shut down in the U.S. too.
Exactly, my whole point. You know, that it's been banned here in the U.S. for years. By the way, Free Speech TV is now carrying some of the feeds from Al Jazeera, and it's also on live stream, which you can get on as an app for free on your phone. So you can follow Al Jazeera. But the fact is that Al Jazeera has been effectively banned here. It was more free in the Middle East to report on what's going on there.
You're
It's been actually excluded in the land of the free here.
By cable.
Yeah.
And cable acting under, I think, you know, two fears. One, the government will put the muscle on them. And two, fear of right-wing crackpots and Israeli interests who will try to punish them commercially for including Al Jazeera in any cable package.
Let's just, we're wrapping up now, Michael Brenner, and I'm so happy that you're joining us. I mean, I think anyone listening to this conversation will have learned a lot about American policy. How do you see, what are the options here, so to speak? Where do you think this is going?
Well, this is always guesswork. I suspect that Mubarak might find a way to ease himself out even before September. The real question is, what will be the nature of a custodial government, and what does that mean in terms of the key question of whether you're going to have free and fair elections, first presidential and then legislative, in September? And the answer to the second depends on the answer to the first. If this becomes, in effect, a quiet coup by the military, easing out Mubarak and dominating a transition government, then your chances of genuinely free elections in the fall go down. If you have a transition government that includes the opposition and figures personalities like El-Baradei, it increases the chances of getting closer to a free election. And then it's the outcome of that election that's really going to determine Egypt's future. We're going to try and meddle. We're probably going to try and meddle by splitting the difference. And that, again, is a recipe for our being used and exploited by the most sort of willful people in the game. And that's going to be the Egyptian military.
Interestingly enough, in the New York Times today, here's the lead op-ed on the op-ed page by Tariq Masood of Harvard, of course, who's giving a rationale for why it's really important for Mubarak to stay, because only he can navigate the waters of trying to get the Constitution reformed and all the rest of it, as if he's cared about the Constitution.
Well, I mean, I don't know the gentleman you refer to, but on the basis of what any reasonably informed person knows about the situation, and the logic of these kinds of revolutionary, or whatever you call them, quasi-revolutionary situations, that's pure and utter nonsense.
Well,
you're not going, the notion that having Mubarak in charge as being, facilitating the move to free and fair elections, I mean, that's propaganda. And frankly, I mean, let's label it as that. And it's the advancing of whatever political agenda this gentleman happens to have.
So I really didn't get to the whole economy in Egypt, which is an extremely interesting story as well.
It's in bad shape.
I'll talk a little bit about that in the next half hour. Nomi Prinz has a fabulous article on our website, NomiPrinz.com, about the CIA's view on Egypt's economy, financial deregulation, and protest. We'll hear about that in a few minutes. Michael Brenner, thank you. I've been trying to get you on this program forever.
You couldn't find me, that's all. I mean, I'd love to do this.
And let's have you back.
Maybe futile, but it's...
No. I think it's very important. We also will have a podcast available of this program with this interview, and you can add it to any website or tell your readers about it as well, so they can listen in. I think you've really made a great contribution to our understanding of all this. Do you agree, Sherry?
Indeed.
It's Sherry from
Atlanta.
Frozen Atlanta.
Yeah.
Yes.
Sherry had one word there which was better than Mad Max. She just said indeed, which is a southern way of saying she loved what you were saying. Thank you again, Michael Brenner. Stay with us.
Send me that link. I'll get it out to people.
Well, definitely will.
Well,
and thank you again for being on with us today. We'll be back in a minute here on News Dissector Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold.
When Wall Street stepped into the fold.
Congress paid off, workers laid off.
Stanford, AIG, and Madoff.
Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets, and empty shops.
And bank walking to AAA.
Grandpa loses 401k.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
South of the border.
Hello, I'm Johnny Mueller, and I have a brand new show called The Expat Files, and it's all about living, working, playing, or retiring in Latin America. I know what it's like to buy land, build a house, start a business. I've been through it in a dozen Latin countries. So, if you're thinking about moving down, or you're just curious, be sure to listen in, Mondays and Wednesdays, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Down Mexico way.
Listen to Of Consuming Interest every Friday from 2 to 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Jim Turner, attorney in Washington, D.C., chairman of the board of Citizens for Health. Every Friday from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern, we discuss a topic of consuming interest, often about health, but also about politics, commerce, and whatever the current topic of the day might be. Of Consuming Interest, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern, on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Bill Bowie.
And this is Kelsey Flynn.
Of Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability.
We bring you news and interviews
with the likes of Wangari Maathai, Bill McKibben, Hazel Henderson, Paul Hawken, Francis Moore LePay, and many others. Tune in to Sea Change Radio here on the Progressive Radio Network on Saturdays at 7 in the evening.
To Cities Grace Notes, where we'll be bringing you inspired voices from around the world, creative voices from various fields and backgrounds, new sounds, new music, and new ideas with your host, CD, every Tuesday at 7 p.m. on Progressive Radio Network.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network, your voice for independent views.
To chase and to walk home via Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also B of A. American Express and Visa Morgan Stanley too. In debt we trust, so pay we must, we owe it all to you.
Well, welcome back. Danny Schechter, your news dissector here. Kat sitting in with me, a new intern, a supporter who's volunteered to help with the work that we're doing to try to get our film Plunder, my earlier film In Debt We Trust, out there. If you can join her, if you have any ideas or want to help in some way, you can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. Sherry, are you with us?
Yes.
Okay, Sherry, I'd like you to introduce Carol Lee here, our next guest, and tell us why you felt so enthusiastic about having her on the program.
All right. This is Carol Lee Kunz, who is a blogger over at the Crooks and Liars website.com. She is a mom as well, and I didn't know you were going to do this to me, so I don't have her information in front of me. Sorry about that, Carol Lee. How do you pronounce your last name?
Kunz.
Kunz. She lives in California, and she's a married mom of three and a wrangler of the pug who rules the house with an iron paw. And the reason I invited Carol Lee on today is she wrote a very interesting piece yesterday that I'd like you to talk about, our policy in the Middle East, 2004 and 2010, and if you'd expound upon the WikiLeaks cables. Take it away, Carol Lee.
Okay. It's been interesting to me to watch Egypt unfold. I have a little bit of a background that wasn't in that bio. A family member of mine served in the diplomatic corps and in that region for over 20 years, including Afghanistan during the Soviet occupation. So I do have a little bit of knowledge about U.S. policy and how screwed up it's been. And so seeing the WikiLeaks cables really drove that home. There were two that were released. Well, there were many that were released yesterday, but there were two in particular that caught my attention. One was from 2004, and it was dealing with the president of Yemen, and essentially revealing the fact that we were doing backroom deals with Yemen in order for them to hold 28 people in prison who were allegedly al-Qaeda, but there was no evidence to that effect. And so they were essentially blackmailing the U.S. government for weapons and attention and standing in that area of the world. And it gives you a real flavor of how the Bush administration handled diplomacy, which was in a very military tit-for-tat fashion. And then you jump up to 2010, and there's a cable discussing human rights in Egypt, and specifically how can the U.S. government put pressure on Mubarak to move to a true democracy with free and fair elections and, you know, the free press and rule of law and all these things. And it was just such a stark contrast between the two approaches to diplomacy in that region. And one of the reasons that our diplomacy is so messed up is because every time we switch back and forth between, you know, a sort of more liberal presidency to a Republican or conservative presidency, the whole approach changes. It goes from the military to the diplomats and human rights aspects. So, but what you see in these cables is from about 2009 on, a concerted effort ahead of even his speech in Cairo to promote democracy in Egypt. And so I believe that what you're seeing now is because the U.S. backed off on the sort of militaristic support and pushed more on the human rights side, and at least cracked the door open for the Egyptians to take control now and stand up for their right to have a true democracy.
Well, as you've noticed, the Mubarak government and its various organs of media and diplomacy are attacking foreigners as being responsible for all this, going after the foreign press, going after human rights activists in Egypt, basically trying to discredit the idea that this is really something that reflects the aspirations of the Egyptian people, but somehow is being manipulated from overseas, which is a typical way in which dictators respond to pressure from below. They attempt to deflect attention onto others. We do it as well in this country, you know, where clearly there's been an effort over the years to look for outside agitators in the South, or, you know, others who might be foreigners who are actually stirring things up here. It's very hard for people in power to recognize that the people they govern don't like them.
Right, right. And blaming outside forces is politically not only inside their country, but outside their country. I mean, it's also a way to, raise pressure from enemies. In other words, if they blame the U.S., that U.S. enemies can rise up and put pressure on the U.S. to back off. It's a standard tactic, just along with all the rest of the nonsense that's come from the government over the last week. That's just been amazingly it's worthy of not much.
Well, you know, you're working in new media, so are Sherry myself, or doing the blog on News Dissector blog on mediachannel.org every day. Social media has played a big role in this situation in Egypt. Actually, the Egyptian government got Vodafone, the phone provider, to send out texts to try to organize the opposition to the protests and to the revolution in Egypt. So, new media is playing a big role. Any thoughts on that, Sherry or Carolee?
Well, I think that new media has been an incredible facilitator. It certainly isn't. I mean, when I see the sort of the reports that suggest that it is what has caused this, I laugh. But what it has done is put tools in the hands of the people who are leading this to be able to get the word out and to organize a little bit. The thing that I think is so interesting is that the very first thing that the government shut down was their internet access. Even before cell phone access, their internet access was shut down, which tells me that the government had real fears about the power of being able to access and organize on the internet.
Egypt is because the stock market there and commerce and business rely on the internet. And so you take the internet out, you're knocking out part of your economy at the same time. And I think that, you know, that reality hit home to the Mubarak people, that it wasn't really very smart. It was counterproductive to do that. At the same time, clearly, you have a situation now where people can call a phone number in Cairo to send out a tweet. You know, there's a lot of workarounds that have been going on here to offer other approaches. And what I'm interested in is also how, when forces of repression try to do something that's particularly brutal, how the people, in a sense, can respond to it and often outflank, you know, the forces of repression, as they've done in building barricades all over the central square in Cairo, as they have in finding a way to get their message out to the world. Although, as we just discussed earlier, the network that's providing the best coverage of all this, Al Jazeera, is not available on most cable outlets in the United States. Free Speech TV is now carrying Al Jazeera feeds. You can get it on live stream on your phone. You can go to aljazeera.net, their website. They picked up a story of mine last week. I was very proud to see. And, I got responses from all over the world. So they are really the ascendant international network, and of course the American people are the last to know about what's going on, because our news and media is so managed and so manipulated. And this is something that I've been fighting on for a long time, and that's part of the reason why I'm participating in this ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, which hopefully will emerge as a bigger force in radio and podcasts and the like. This show, by the way, is also accessible on iTunes, is also accessible on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com website. So we're trying to get the word out here, as is Crooks and Liars, which is quite an interesting website. Can you tell us more about it?
Well, Crooks and Liars has been around for about 6-7 years now. John Amato started it, and originally the main focus is still, and was then, trying to call out the Fox News, the propaganda spinners in our mainstream media, and set, you know, put the truth on record. And that's what Crooks and Liars is best at. Before anybody was putting video on their site, John was putting video of the crazy people on Fox. He was getting it up on the site with debunking what they said. And we've continued on that. I'm really glad to be on Crooks and Liars. It's a great site. And as you said, it gives us a platform to be able to get some a different point of view out there. And if there's one thing that I hope our mainstream media takes away from the whole persecution of journalists in Egypt, it is how irresponsible they have been with the truth. And maybe there will be some reporters that start being more responsible or start getting a voice or deciding that they're going to go somewhere when they get a voice like this network. Because we really are the least informed country right now. And I've been an Al Jazeera fan for a while, so I'm with you on the fact that it ought to be broadcast all over the country.
Both of you are talking about is so interesting. And if you think about it, look at the dedication and the perseverance of the Egyptians. They don't let no internet stop them, no phone, no being able to tweet. They don't even let barbed wire. They're climbing over tanks. They're doing everything. They so want this. Do you think the American public would do that? We have a conniption fit if one of our apps doesn't work on a cell phone.
Point well made. I would just say,
I'm staying home. I can't get an app. Democracy be damned.
I would just say one thing about all this. You know, I mean, I agree with exposing Fox News in a way, and in a way that's the easy thing to do. Exposing all of this mainstream media, from the New York Times to, you know, ABC News where I work, to CBS. I mean, we have to provide not only a critique of the media, but an effective alternative that's well marketed, that's interesting, that people want to listen to and want to read. And, you know, we have elements of it. We have prototypes of it. I certainly try in my own way to contribute to it on mediachannel.org and the News Dissector blog. But I think there's too much kind of a reflex action on the left among progressives, you know, oh my God, did you see what Glenn Beck said yesterday? You know, all their energy is going into being provoked by a provocateur. That's what he's there to do. He's there to get you upset, rather than trying to figure out a way to arm the people in the United States with the information they need to know, including the information about our economy, which is why I made the film Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, as a way to try to do that, to show how the basic Wall Street crisis is a crime story. And, Nomi Prinz, I mentioned earlier, in her website, NomiPrinz.com, has some thoughts on all of this, referring to the CIA World Factbook depiction of Egypt's economy. And Cairo, from 2004 to 2008, aggressively pursued economic reforms to attract foreign investment, facilitate GDP growth. And while that was happening, according to her article, despite the relatively high levels of economic growth over the past few years, living conditions for the average Egyptian remains poor. Most live on $2 a day. Unemployment in Egypt is hovering just below the 10% mark, like in the U.S. Today it went down a little to 9%, but only 36,000 jobs were created. Similarly, this figure grossly underestimates underemployment, quality of employment, prospects for employment, and the growing youth population with a dismal job future. So we can't just pay attention to Mubarak. We have to look at the structure of the economy in Egypt and here. So, Carolee, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and we want to call attention to your work. Where can they find this article again that you just did?
It's on crooksandliars.com.
Well, there you go. Thank you. You know, we have this program on a podcast, and we'll be sending you a copy. Maybe Crooks and Liars would want to run it. Sherry, thank you so much for hooking us up with the Crooks and Liars connection here. Carolee, thank you for being part of the show. I hope we can have you on again. We just have a little treat you can listen in that we didn't really plan on, and Sherry doesn't even know about. But Stefan Saeed, who is a singer of international repute, international, you know, respect, has agreed to come by the studio and tell us a little bit about this Arab freedom anthem that he's written. We played a little bit of it at the beginning of the show. We want to spend a little time, the remaining time we have now, with Stefan, talking about what he's doing here and what this is, because this is very important. You know, inspiration, popular culture, music, all of this helps inspire people to act, inspire people to learn more, and all the rest of it. So, Stefan, welcome to the program. Speak into the microphone here, and just tell us a little bit about what you've done.
Hi, Danny. Well, you know, I didn't write this song. I wrote the music for it in Newly, but the song is Ayd Ba'ish Tahriya, and it's a song that I learned from my father. It's probably the most famous allegorical anthem for freedom that came out of Egypt in the anti-colonial era in the 1930s. It was written by Egypt's poet laureate Ahmed Shawki. It was originally put to music by the famous composer Muhammad Abdul Wahab in 1937. And, you know, anybody from the Arab world knew this. All their parents knew this song. The children, we all know it because our parents knew it. It wasn't one of the huge hits that Muhammad Abdul Wahab wrote for Kulthum, although it was equally well known.
She was a great singer,
right,
in Egypt, an amazing voice of international stature.
In any case, just as a, you know, as you know, I spend my life as an Arab American. I've grown up. I think it's the most important thing for us to think of is to get out of only this, the what's happening in Egypt and in Tunisia across the Arab world is not only movement for freedom and equality in our own nations. We have to get into the mindset and realize that everybody is living in a global era now in which we realize that the current economic system is not sustainable. There's no way of removing that. We realize that the only way this is really going to be stopped is if not only we create more equal societies in our own countries, but globally. So I'd have to say that for me, I recorded a song actually for my new album as an anthem as an Arab American who's grown up having to deal with being from a race or from people that have been in the crosshairs of globalization, really at the epicenter of it. We're getting shot and bombed for 100 years to maintain an economic system built around dwindling resources that happen to be located predominantly in where we come from. That's why. It's the same reason why the civil rights era had to start in the South. It's where the people are getting shot and killed. And so I recorded this song actually months ago with Hal Wilner, a renowned producer who's made my new album that'll be coming out this year. Only feeling the zeitgeist and really just a personal need to express this. And it is just obviously a sign of the times. And here we just decided before the album came out to release it because it couldn't have been more handpicked.
So. Can you sing a little for us and then we're going to go out with the actual recording?
Okay. It goes like this. It goes, and if you heard the Abdul Wahab, you'd know. It starts with him solo and he goes, which is, I love the life of freedom. So it's, مطرح ما بيني نوم أنا وأنا مرتاح البال
غير الحال يوما يوم ما اشوف قلبي ميال ما حبت عيشتين هدية احبت عيشتين هدية
Wow. I mean, Stefan, even the people outside are applauding. I mean, you know, beautifully done and really kind of riveting in a way, because we really, if we are going to support Egypt, if we are going to, you know, speak out on behalf of human rights for all, we have to appreciate the cultures in other countries. We have to understand and be moved by their music and be open to their music. And I think this is something that you've helped promote. What's been the response that you've had so far to people who've heard this?
It's been, you know, we put it up online a few days ago, and it's just starting to, you know, there's already remixes and video mashups that have been made. If we go on in the last few days, it's been ahead of, you know, a number of thousands of times on the internet. Of course, I put up versions with an introductory explanation, one in English, one in French, because I speak French, and one with Arabic. And so it can be viewed basically by people from the entire region, and which is amazing to see online when, you know, we look at the analytics at YouTube. It's literally being listened to all over the world, not in America only, but it's all across Africa, not just Northern Africa, and in the Middle East and Europe, of course, but also South America. So it's, you know, over the next few days, Alternate did a great piece on it. The Examiner did a wonderful piece, and I just wrote an op-ed that I'm hoping is going to show up someplace tomorrow. And I'm working with probably the biggest youth organization now out of the Middle East called Mideast Youth. They were the TED Fellowship winner in 2009 to have a really set up overnight, basically, hip-hop or rap remix competition for youth throughout the Arab world to do their own versions and rap their own lyrics over top of it. So that's going to be going up in the next, you know, 48 hours probably.
Well, look, that's really fabulous. We only have a few minutes left on this particular program, but I want to thank you so much for stopping in, even for a short burst of some creative juice, you know, into this program. We talk a lot here, but I've always believed that the power of music is really more educational in many ways, the things we remember more than the words that we speak. And I worked at Rock and Roll Radio in Boston, WBCN, for a long time. I've been involved with the Sun City Project against apartheid and other musical projects. I've had some, you know, dealings here with Stefan for quite a few years, and I've watched him emerge as a leading voice of music and culture. So thank you so much for just stopping in at the last. Literally, I spoke to him a few minutes before the program and said drop by, and here he is. So thank you. We're going to go out with the song as recorded.
I should tell them where you, people, if they go to my website, it's for the easiest. I mean, you'll find it on YouTube. It's Stefan Saeed, but it's S-T-E-P-H-A-N Saeed, just like Edward Saeed, or the word said, S-A-I-D. So StefanSaeed.com, and then you'll at least be able to go and find it.
So there you are. Thank you again. This is our News Dissector Radio. You can follow my work on NewsDissector.com/blog every day. You can check out my film at PlunderTheCrimeOfOurTime.com. Thank you, Sherry, for putting this program together. Thank you, Kat, for sitting here. I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to really chat with you on the show. Maybe in future weeks we can. Stefan Saeed, you know I try to get it all in if I can. So let's go out with this song, if we can.
أحب عيشة الحرية أحب عيشة الحرية زي طيور بين الأغصان مدى الحبايب حواليا كل بلاد عندي أوطان مطرح ما يجي بيني النوم أنام وأنا مرتاح البال غير الحال يوم
الشوف قلبي ميال يا حبيبي اشتركوا